Well, when I was last together with the group here, that's pretty loud, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago, I was focusing in my talk and we were on in our discussion, we were focusing about how to mindfully do work that brings the Dharma to bear in the realm of social action on, I don't call it a climate emergency or crisis anymore, because I found those words are so overused that they've begun to lose their meaning. I think based in part on my own experience and what brought me to the Dharma, which was actually healing from trauma associated with being at war in Vietnam in the 1960s. I've come to understand what I think is happening for us now more is what I've begun to call climate trauma, which is to say, we, those of us who feel ourselves to be engaged with or connected with the world in a sentient way, not just sort of in the abstract or intellectually, but in the fibers of our being, you know, when we're in our gardens or walking outside, and attending to the quality and the nature of life on Earth, we've begun to become aware that our environment globally, as well as locally, is undergoing a significant amount of trauma, harm, or violent harm. And it's occasioned mostly by the carbon-based energy systems that we were born into in voluntary reliance upon, but also the global, corporate capitalist economic systems on which trade relies. That most of our major institutions seem geared toward consumption of the earth and posing a pretty direct threat to the life-sustaining capabilities of the earth. So trying to address what I think all of us are feeling in terms of a traumatic response to what's going on has become more and more of how I'm spending my time these days. And so I've begun to self-identify as an environmental chaplain, basically. And by that I mean, you know, there's a very, and I one of the areas I offer chaplaincy services is with the Colorado Voluntary Organizations Act in Disasters, which is basically providing services to people who have been the victims of environmental disasters, whether in this state or elsewhere in the country, floods and fires and whatnot. And in that regard, there's this very distinct and important difference between what are called pastoral services and chaplaincy services. And with regard to pastoral services, that's somebody who is seminary trained like me. And if you're with your own congregation, your own sangha, we're discussing these matters within the idiom of our tradition. And we're using that language. And we're coming to a common understanding of it through that language. Chaplaincy services, by contrast, are very different. That has nothing whatsoever to do with trying to bring your own religious or spiritual orientation to bear on the situation, but rather simply being with and being witness to a person in a place of need, or perhaps a place of crisis or trauma, and seeking to discern what their own spiritual orientation is, and how they understand what's going on within, and trying to support how they are seeking to help themselves. And also picking up on the kinds of sort of existential questions that get asked in times of crisis, which, what's going on? What happened here? How can I put myself back together again? how can I respond to the grief that I'm feeling at the loss of my home, or you know, whatever it is that's going on? Or in the case of one of my principal areas of activity right now is actually caring for environmental caregivers. So starting later this month, I'm offering a secular introduction to mindfulness meditation class for the staff and volunteers at client organizations at the Alliance Center in downtown Denver. And that's where various environmental organizations have their state or regional headquarters, like the Sierra Club and Conservation Colorado and Climate Justice and Western Resource Advocates and whatnot. And most of the people in those organizations, they have burnout for lunch every day. And so it's basically an effort to help meet the emotional and spiritual needs of those people without putting any kind of Buddhist gloss on it or anything. Just through teaching a straight-up secular mindfulness meditation class, mindfulness for the purpose of stress reduction and stress management. So it's this sense that that there are all kinds of challenges that are being faced, and there are many ways to face them through political action and whatnot, but that one of the more overlooked aspects of the needs that we feel within ourselves as well as others are these very deeply rooted spiritual needs. And and dukkha associated with grief for the trauma being suffered by the earth, which is not different from the trauma that we suffer as a result of our relationship to the living world. So last week when we got, or the last time we were together, what I was offering was a way to address that kind of suffering with the recognition that when we feel, and there are, for people that are doing this kind of work, burnout is an ever-present possibility. And so it's really important to always be aware of what the symptoms are in case you begin to start feeling them. Okay. And they oftentimes include something like feelings of isolation or aloneness, you know, that you're really trying to do this out there on your own. Feelings of overwhelm, you know, like I was talking about last time we were together, it's like that the need is so great and the demands are so huge that I'm completely unequal to meeting them, which is associated again with this feeling of isolation. And then thirdly, a feeling of kind of a lack of support or recognition or acknowledgement, or that you're with others who are all in this sort of thing together. And that whenever you begin to feel those things starting to go on, it's really, really important to do what in the, at least in the Chinese martial arts, like in Tai Chi, it's called return to center. It's like, you know, you're out there in the swirl in the realm of activity, but you have to return to center. You have to come back to this place that helps you remember why you're doing all this stuff in the first place. And so, among the ways, because all of those feelings of despair and overwhelm and whatnot come from relating to the situation that we're working with from a perspective of self. I am overwhelmed. I am alone. I am without support. And so ultimately, the constructive way to work with that is to find means of encountering and working with the situation, not from a place of I, but from a place that allows you to stand a little to one side. Like I've said, you know, with regard to mindfulness meditation generally, like a kind and caring parent watching a child in the playground. You know? You want to let them run free and have fun and whatnot, but you also don't want to hurt themselves or others. And so you watch what's going on from that perspective. And in this particular situation, as we were speaking about in the subject of from 2 weeks ago, what I called Gaya Dharmakaya, which is to say learning to apprehend or to take in the situation, not from the perspective of me personally, born a few years ago, going to die a few years later, but rather me as one of, you know, like the human body, one of 40 trillion cells. You know, several hundred thousand of which are being born and dying in every second. You know, there were this part of something much greater. You know, and we are part of this great body of the one living thing, Gaia, you know, which she's not feeling great right now, you know. She's kind of running a low-grade fever that may spike before too much longer, and fevers perform a very cathartic function in most mammalian bodies, which is to kill off pathogens. The unfortunate case this time around being that the pathogen appears to be us. And so running the fever may have the, you know, the effect of removing the pathogen from the body of Gaia. You know, we're kind of hoping that doesn't happen, because what we'd like to do as a species is to stick around if we can. And so we're trying to learn how to be antibodies as well as pathogens. And we're not pathogens because we want to be. We're pathogens because we were born into involuntary reliance on carbon-based energy systems. And so now we're doing what we can to heal the planet, to bring down the temperature and whatnot. But we are in, you know, it seems to be this kind of horse race, right? Are we going to be able to do it in time to save ourselves? So that was the trying to find a non-self-referential point of view in terms of space. This evening, I want to throw out some ideas that we can talk about in terms of finding a non-self-referential point of view in terms of time. Because inevitably, our tendency is to think about the environmental trauma that we're facing now, increasingly serious, from the vantage point of us, right? Of us in this lifetime. How is it that we came to find ourselves in this situation, in this point in time? What may we be or not able to be able to do about this situation from the standpoint of us here and now in this generation? And so what I want to do this evening is to suggest some ways that we can think more broadly in terms of time. To think about time from this non-self-referential point of view again. Okay. So Earth scientists have this concept they talk about called deep time. And by deep time, they mean time measured in billions of years, you know, from the 4.5 billion years or so that the Earth came into being and then life began to generate and so on and so forth. Going to whittle it down for us a little, and so it's not quite so, you know, unable to relate to it all. So, of course, I'm going to do it by reference to us. Also, in inviting us to look at time in very broad terms, you know, far beyond when we first showed up, or and far beyond, you know, when we may or may not be as a species here in the future. To consider this notion of vast expanses of time from the perspective of the Dharma. And the Buddha, when he was teaching these things, he talked about deep time a fair amount, actually. He talked about you know, the vast and distant past and everything that led up to this point in time. He talked about eons. He talked about his memories of his own past existences and those of others and whatnot. And then he brought things to the present moment, and then he also spoke of the future. Because what he spoke of, he said that just, you know, as is the case for us now, even back then he was saying our inevitable tendency is to look at the past and the future from the perspective of who we think we are in this moment in time. From the time we individually arose and the time that we are here and from the time that we pass away. And he said that this tendency of mind to only view the world through the lens of who we are in this body and who we consider ourselves to be as a person this time around is not only very limiting, it is also a source of suffering. And so what he invited us to do instead is to understand who we are, not as an isolated and individual and discrete being, but as one of a vast array of beings that are all participating in what he called the process of consciousness. That we are all like individual snowflakes, part of a flow, an ongoing flow. So, understood from this perspective, we are this temporary accumulation of matter, okay, with this process of consciousness that temporarily comes into being and takes form that we, in a way that we call ourselves. You know, a few months ago when we were speaking about these things, I used the simile of the hydrologic cycle, you know, of a molecule of water and a cloud moving over the Sierra Nevada in California in the summertime and precipitating this rain down into a lake and then flowing from the lake northward in Upper Bridal Veil Creek to the lip of a cliff, and then you become water. Bridal Veil Falls, and then you're lower Bridal Veil Creek, and then you become the Merced River, and then you join with the San Joaquin River, and then you flow out to sea, and then the whole thing starts all over again. So the Buddha taught our ideas about who we are in that way, in a cyclical way. He said what the mind is doing is continuously in the process of conjuring self. And so all these various elements, all the memories, all the things that ever happened to us, you know, over the course of a lifetime, flow together and they define who we are at any given point in time. Oh, I am Ostrander Lake. Oh, I am Upper Bridal Veil Creek. Oh, I am Bridal Veil Falls. Oh, I am Lower Bridal Veil Creek. Oh, I am the Merced River. Oh, I am the San Joaquin River, which is kind of a bummer because in addition to all this fresh high country water, you've got hydrocarbons and cow shit and, you know, and synthetic organic fertilizers and whatnot coming in from the fields. Oh, this is yucky. This isn't fun anymore. And then you flow into the San Joaquin Sacramento Delta, and the marshes filter the water, and then you flow into the San Francisco Bay, and then you flow out to sea. And then you get, you know, then you get raised up into the clouds again, you know. So it's just this ongoing process. There's some aspects of our karma, these pollutants and whatnot that come in from various directions. The way people may have treated us in the past that caused us harm and made us feel bad. And that gets mixed into who we are. Things that we may have done in the past that were unwholesome, they get mixed into who we are and have to do with our self-regard. beneficial things that we've done, right? It's all part of this great swirl. So the Buddha tells us that the mind is continuously creating self. And the ingredients for self are our past actions and the intentions that underlay them. And so one of the descriptions of the practice we do, it's most often called mindfulness meditation, but within the realm of mindfulness practice, vipassana is a Pali word for insight, essentially. It's also called insight meditation. That's why we call it the Insight Meditation Community of Denver and the Insight Meditation Community of Colorado. Because the function of this practice is to make possible the arising of insights. Insights into what? Insights into the relationship between our past actions. Not only our own past actions, our words and our deeds, but also the past actions of others who influenced who we consider ourselves to be. The past beneficial actions of others who helped nourish us and sustain us and give us confidence in ourselves. The past actions of people who treated us poorly, who caused us to feel self-doubt, to feel afraid or to feel contracted, or condition us to make it more likely that we do things that are unskillful. Going for all of these things come together. When we are unconscious of or unaware of or unawakened to how all of these past karmic fruits are affecting us, then we are more likely to speak or act with unwholesome intention in the future. So the way the Buddha taught that we begin to become able to bring suffering for ourselves and others to cessation is by waking up to the relationship between our past karmic conditioning and our present state. Especially how our past karmic conditioning affects our intentions before we speak or before we act. So the better we become, the better able we are to develop insights into how we were conditioned in the past, how our mind works in the present, and how we express who we are in the future, the better able we become to stop creating suffering for ourselves and others going forward. Okay. So that is kind of how it works in terms of cause and effect. And so as we're rebirthing ourselves moment to moment to moment, okay, if we're waking up, if we're mindful of what's going on, with each rebirth of the self, we're able to see a little more clearly what the effects of the past inputs were into our state of mind now, and become a little freer in terms of not repeating unwholesome behaviors in the future. That cycle happening on a moment-to-moment basis, the Buddha also taught, is not different from the thing, what happens when this body dies. So at the time of the Buddha, there were these different ideas, just like there are today, about what happens when this body dies. Where they're poof, that's it. You know, you're out of here, nada. You know, all gone, gone, bye bye. Or the other thought that was the dominant religion extant at the time, you know, Hinduism, was that there is this process of reincarnation, a separate and eternal self that gets reborn through successive bodies going forward, hopefully purifying itself along the way. Okay. And the Buddha taught neither one of those. He said that there is no permanent self that gets reborn over and over again, nor is there nothing but nihilism at the end. What he taught instead is that there is this process that he that, you know, the scholars today translating his words refer to as process of consciousness, a transmission of information, of memory actually, across space and time, from the being who is just extinguished to a being who is being born. So that is an ongoing process insofar as the way the Buddha taught it. And whatever all the combined karmic effects were that conditioned consciousness at the time of its leaving one body also carry over into the next. That's the individual model. However, it also applies to societies and to civilizations. So in addition to each of us having inherited our own personal cause and effect bundles, you know, and karma oftentimes is kind of misunderstood as a term in the West. It's thought of as, oh, that's your karma, you know. It's thought of as consequences. That's not really the case at all. The Sanskrit and Pali translation of karma is, in English, is action. It's the doing of a thing. Especially in the realm of Buddhism, it's the doing of a thing with intention, either with beneficial intention or with unwholesome intention. Okay. The fruition of the action, the Pali word is vipaka. That's what it means. It means fruition. So there's action and fruition. So when we're talking about karmic fruition, the karma is the action, the fruition is what we're experiencing as a result of that action. As a society, as a civilization, as a global community, we are now, in terms of environmental trauma, experiencing the karmic fruition of about 200 to 300 years of reliance on carbon-based energy systems. And so just as individuals, when we begin through the practice of insight meditation to awaken to the relationship between past karma and current intention, current state of mind, so too, one way to understand what's going on with regard to the environmental trauma, global environmental trauma that we find ourselves in, is that we are awakening collectively to developing insight into the relationship between the generation of and the reliance upon carbon-based energy systems and what they are doing to life on Earth. And so just as we awaken to our past karma and the vipaka, the fruition of past karma in ways that we caused harm to ourselves and others, we're awakening to the past actions that are causing manifest harm to life on Earth in the present time. And so if you think about, you know, Dharmakaya, you know, the Gaya Dharmakaya, you know, the earth is one great being. If we think about ourselves as one great consciousness, then that's kind of what's going on. To the extent that we are collectively able to wake up to the harmful effects of past karma, we stand some chance of reducing the severity and the longevity of suffering going forward. Okay. To the extent that collectively we're unable to do so, we continue to replicate that suffering. and perhaps to make it worse. When I'm looking for science data to rely upon, because sometimes the news media I find to be unduly alarmist and almost seeking to create panic rather than consensus around concerted action, I tend to look mostly toward the analyses that have been done by the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And about 5 years ago, they came up, the atmospheric scientists and all the other hard science people, natural science people, and the social science people came together, and they had a look at the trends that we're undergoing right now, and they said, okay, we need to try to scope out or to flesh out what different possible future paths might be for humankind in its relationship to the environment, depending on actions that we do or do not take in the short term. And so they teased out four different scenarios. And also teased out the probability of any of them occurring. Okay. And of the four scenarios, only one of them, RCP 8.5, predicted a path toward possible environmental catastrophe. And they said that path would be the one that would be followed if we had full knowledge of the ways that we are in the process of making the planet unlivable for ourselves and did nothing about it. And then they had these other scenarios that they teased out. And they said, well, these are the, and they didn't necessarily assign probabilities. They just looked at each of these four and said that really the choice is ours. The other four that did not lead to catastrophe all assumed that within a relatively short period of time, there would be an understanding shared of the potential catastrophe that we all shared, and that meaningful actions would be taken at the level of the nation state, internationally, in terms of international trade and reconfiguration of energy systems and whatnot, that would alleviate and avert that catastrophic path and take us down one or another of these other ones. Well, that was 5 years ago. Their most recent assessment is one that says not only is scenario 8.5 being followed, but it's being exceeded. They assumed that carbon buildup would stay stable, perhaps, and then maybe begin to table off. The buildup of carbon in the atmosphere is accelerating. It's getting worse faster than any of the predictions so far. Okay. And so their most recent assessment is that we're not only on the path to this 8.5 scenario, but we are in fact going beyond it faster than we thought we would. And if radical changes don't come about in a very short period of time, we as a species are in very deep trouble. That's pretty much what they came up with. which is, it's like Zorba the Greek said about self-knowledge, it's seldom good news. And it can be a real cause for hopelessness. So it's like, what's the point, In looking at deep time, however, one of the things that really struck me is that there's probably a great deal more cause for hope than we think there is. Not hope that we're going to stop things and make them all better and go back to how things were. It's not a matter of whether things are going to get worse. It's a matter of how much worse and how fast. And I've been doing a lot of reading lately on recent archaeological studies that pretty much kind of tended to turn a lot of the old thinking on its head. You know, we were all taught in school that, you know, the continents we call the Americas now were first inhabited about 12 or 13,000 years ago by people hiking over the land bridge from Siberia to Alaska. And all this, but now the more archaeology they do in South America, the more they're finding 30,000-year-old civilizations. So that theory's out the window. And now the thinking is they probably came down the west coast of the Americas in hide-covered boats about 30,000 years ago. Came all the way down the coast of North America, all the way down to South America, and began populating both continents. And that prior to the first European exposure, there were about 100 million people living in the Americas. Including probably at least 15 million or so here in the United States, what we now call the United States. And they had been living sustainably on the earth for thousands and thousands of years. And they had been actively manipulating the environment for all that time, and they'd figure out how to make it work over the very long haul, over thousands of years. And according to that thinking and that modeling, what happened with the first European contact and the bringing of diseases for which the peoples of these continents had no defenses, that within a couple hundred years, the populations, indigenous populations of the Americas were literally decimated, which is to say, reduced by a factor of 10. More than 90% of all the people living in the Americas died off, mostly as a result of disease. And that continued to happen, you know, right up through the period of European colonization. But what we do have, you know, so we're cranking it down from eons and eons to 300,000 years ago when humans first appeared on the earth, to 30,000 years ago when people first started populating the Americas. Let's crank it down now to 300 years ago. 300 years ago, in the northeastern United States, we had various indigenous tribes who had entered into alliances with each other for mutual defense and other purposes. At the time the English colonists came to the Northeast, one of these alliances they encountered was something called the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. And that was a confederacy of five and then six tribes in what's now sort of New York, Northern Pennsylvania, and whatnot. The Mohawks, the Oneida, the Senecas, Onondaga. And those tribes, for centuries prior to that time, had been in conflict with each other. They'd been at war with each other. And mostly what they'd been at war with each other over was natural resources. So one tribe's territories, they would deplete their resource base, they would overhunt. And then they would start encroaching on the other's territories, and so they'd go to war. And at some point, around 1300 or 1400, they said, well, you know, this isn't really working for any of us. And so they came together, and they formed this confederacy. All of these tribes were matriarchal and matrilineal. And so what happened was forming the Haudenosaunee Confederacy was that the matriarchs of all the tribes chose which male representative was going to go into convocation with the other tribes. And their instructions were, as they went there, as you enter into agreements with these other tribes, you must see to the well-being of those of us who are now alive, but you must give equal attention to those who are yet to come. And so that was the charge of these people, these military leaders that came together and formed the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Essentially, what they were doing was, they were entering into a peace treaty, an agreement not to continue to fight each other. But the other thing they were doing was entering into an agreement that each tribe would manage its resource base in such a way as to not create shortage, so they would not feel inclined to attack a neighboring tribe. So it was basically an intertribal resource management agreement, like an international hunting treaty across all these tribes. And they all agreed that it was going to be important for them to manage their own lands in such a way as to ensure the support for generations yet to come. And so when the American colonists really kind of stumbled onto this and decided that this is kind of important stuff, they wrote down the Haudenosaunee Confederacy Constitution. And one of the early clauses in it says just that. It says you are charged with protecting the well-being of the peoples now alive. And then the way the language of the Constitution reads is that you must have hide thick enough to that you must have the hide thickness of 7. And by that, what was meant was that there will be those within your respective tribes who want to just gobble it all up now and then go off and start, you know, ripping off the other tribes. And he said, you have to be able to resist that compulsion. And it's still up in the air whether they meant 7 generations in the future or whether they were actually talking about, said, you know, the 3 generations that were still alive. You know, there's still people who were in the tribe who'd been alive for 3 generations and then the 3 generations yet to come. They said, your responsibility is to make sure that that which has been assured to us by the 3 generations before us will likewise be available to the 3 generations to come. So it was a teaching about the necessity of relating to the earth in a way that sustained both the earth and the tribe. That's part of our own political history, because when Benjamin Franklin was responsible, when he became a leader of the colony of Pennsylvania, for negotiating treaties with the surrounding tribes. And at the same time, he was trying to get the other British colonies to enter into a similar mutual agreement, you know, for sustainability and mutual defense. And he was getting nowhere. And so finally in 1854, they got together and he presented what he called the Albany Plan of Union. And it was based explicitly on the Constitution of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. He said, we call these people savages, you know, but look at how they live. They have no police, they have no jails, they have no armies, and they live sustainably on the earth. Cannot we who profess to be civilized do the same thing? And so he presented that argument. Of course, got nowhere, but as a result, the British almost lost the French and Indian War. But that potential within humankind and human governance exists. When I was writing this book a few years ago on the management of sacred sites and resources on public lands, I was working at the time with an organization called the Intertribal Bison Cooperative, and it was a coalition of tribes here in the western states that were working on bringing bison back onto their lands, onto tribal lands, as a way of ritually rebirthing their own cultures, but also as a way of bringing high quality protein to feed their tribes. And so I was invited to attend a ceremony called a deer dance at the Taos Pueblo. And the Pueblo peoples of northern Rio Grande Valley are thought to have migrated from the ancestral Pueblan cities, and like Mesa Verde, for instance. You know, they inhabited these vast urban centers with a lot of people and vast agriculture upon the mesas and whatnot. The populations of those centers grew to the point where they were right at the edge in terms of the size of the populations and the population density of the urban centers and their resource carrying capacity in terms of the amount of food they could grow and the wildlife and all that. And then they came upon 2.5 generations of extreme drought and resource-based collapse. And so did the sort of the civilizations, and they all had to migrate away to where there was more water. So I was witnessing a ceremony called the Deer Dance at Taos Pueblo. And the way the Deer Dance works is that there's a huge kind of oblong space created by the women wearing buckskin with pine boughs painted on their dresses and holding pine boughs and dancing, and they symbolize the forest. And what they were actually symbolizing, what the dance is about, is the recreation of the way that the Pueblo peoples actually went about hunting up in the mountains, which is to say, they would go up there and the hunters would go up around on the ridgetops, around to the top of a steep canyon, and they would start making a lot of racket and beating the bushes and whatnot with sticks and whatnot. And it would have the effect of hurting all the wildlife down the walls of the canyon to the canyon base, and then trying to run out through the mouth of the canyon and down there were the hunters. And so they'd start picking off the wildlife as they were running through. But they did that for a while, and they realized they pretty much almost wiped out the resource base. And so they had to kind of rethink how they did things, and that's what the Deer Dance was. It was the recreation of this lesson. So the women formed like the canyon, right? And I only later did it occur to me it was also in approximately the same dimensions as a uterus. And then from the kiva came all the male dancers, and they were all portraying the animals. They were all dressed up as buffalo or as deer or rabbits or various other kinds of wildlife. And they were led into the enclosure, and they would dance around there, and then they would start to leave, and the clowns were the pantomiming being the hunters, killing the wildlife as they tried to leave the canyon, and they'd sling them over their shoulder and they'd bring them back. But also standing at the mouth of the canyon were these two really tall guys in a white buckskin, and the tribal official who invited me to the ceremony later on, he said, you know, the closest English word probably is wardens. And so every time these hunters would try to leave the canyon with their slain wildlife, the wardens would compel them to release the wildlife and give them life and bring them and let them flee back up again to the canyon. And so what the Deer Dance was doing was teaching the people in the tribe over and over again what it means to deplete the resource base beyond sustainability. So as Richard Achuleta, the guy who invited me, was telling me, he said, as he explained to me the ritual, he said, the hunters have a lot of knowledge and skill, a lot of power. They've figured out how to kill a lot of wildlife, enough to completely wipe out the resource base. He said, what they lack is wisdom. They don't understand that what they're doing is destroying the ability of the life on earth to sustain the tribe. And the role of the wardens is to teach them that lesson over and over and over again. So they've been doing the deer dance now for several hundred years. And that's what the teaching is. Don't over-exploit the resource base or you will destroy your own society. So those teachings are there, they're out there, you know. And they've been with us for a long time. When we do the metta practice, we, you know, as the Buddha taught it, you know, we do metta for ourselves, for our loved ones, for others, for all beings who live on the earth, and within it, all beings who fly in the skies above and who swim in the waters below. All beings now alive, all beings yet to be born. Ta-da! For 2,500 years, Buddhists have been sending metta to us. Right? That's why we're here. That's why we're able to share the Dharma together, because they were sending metta to us, you know, for our well-being, for our ability to learn the Dharma. When we say those words, we are sending metta to generations yet to be born. So when we think about deep time and we think about the work that we may be doing, you know, around the environment or whatever, we're not just doing it for ourselves. We are in fact doing it for those yet to be born. And so in the popular vernacular, it's like Groucho Marx, you know, and somebody raised the issue with him. He said, to hell with future generations, what have they ever done for me? So, right. It's one thing if you're, you know, if you're a nihilist and say, well, I'm out of here, too bad for the ones to come. We're not. We're those who at least abide contemplating the possibility of rebirth. That we're not just doing this work now in order to try to better harmonize our own relationship to the earth, but also on behalf of who we are to become. Because we may well be reborn into the future that we are helping to create. We may well find ourselves experiencing the future karmic consequences of the things that we do now. So the more that we can do now to make life better for those to come, the better may be our own experience. If the Buddha happens to be right about rebirth. I'm sorry I didn't leave time for discussion, but let's take just a moment if we can to settle back into our city postures. Maybe live with ease. And know ease and well-being. May we be well. May we be sound in our bodies and our quality of mind. May we be safe from all inner matter harm. May we be free from all mental and physical suffering. May we be at peace with the way things are. May we find the courage and the kindness. To help alleviate the suffering of those yet to become. All beings, may all beings be happy, peaceful, and free. All beings now alive, all beings walking the earth and living within it, all beings flying in the skies above, swimming in the waters below. both seen and unseen. Just as a mother protects with her child, her own child, with her life of human being, so too with a balanced heart may we cherish all living beings, suffusing the entire world with unobstructed loving kindness. All beings now alive, and all beings yet to be born. May all beings be happy. May all beings be peaceful. And may all beings be free.
Good night, everybody. Have a safe journey home.